Time to take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thank you for listening in today. And if you have a question, something that's bothering you or you're curious about relating to wildlife here in the state or elsewhere, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us at talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Scott, welcome back.
Well, Happy New Year, Larry, and to all the listeners. It's good to be starting out a new year, I guess.
Yeah, it's great. How about for the wildlife out there during this winter time?
Well, so far things haven't been too problematic. Mm-hmm. There was some ice for a while, and the crust was a little difficult for some species, and now we've had a big thaw here about a week ago, and the snow cover is pretty well frozen. So for those things that need to scratch through, some of the songbirds and pheasants and turkeys and whatnot, it might be a little difficult, but there's also some open patches that should mitigate that. So really depends on what happens for the rest of the winter. But, you know, we think of, and my wife brings it up all the time, you know, you go in the house, or you stick your nose outside and it's 20 below zero and it's whatever. It's just, oh my gosh, how are those animals getting by out there? And the reality is, it's not an easy life, but the animals that live here are adapted to do that, and they know how to find shelter or burrow down in powder snow when we have it, or find a hollow tree cavity, or curl up out of the wind. And for the most part, the strategies of those animals that don't migrate or hibernate get them through pretty well, except in really extreme circumstances. And so far, the winter hasn't been all that bad.
We had on my Facebook page, Mary Beth sent a note on the Facebook page and said, I saw some deer run across the road and into a wooded area yesterday, and I wondered how habitual deer are where they spend their days and nights. Would those deer try to return to the woods a quarter mile away where they had come from, or would they just be just as content in the new area? How long would they wait to return if they did? Do they sleep in the same spots every night as long as they're suitable, or do they just occupy any nice bedding area?
Well, in reality, Mary Beth, the deer are pretty habitual, and they, I mean, deer, like many animals, have what we call a home range, which you know, may cover a few hundred acres, and they know that area within their home range very well. So if there's a favorite ridgetop that tends to be out of the wind, out of the prevailing wind, and have a good sight line on the surrounding countryside where they feel safe, then they'll use that bedding area repeatedly. And, of course, deer hunters realize that deer are quite, not entirely predictable, but somewhat predictable in terms of where they bed, where they feed, and the movement corridors they use between bedding and feeding areas. So that's the basis for many successful archery hunters and the placement of trail cameras and things like that. So the short answer is, if they're using a woodlot, chances are they use that woodlot repeatedly unless they're disturbed or disrupted. But there may be a number of woodlots suitable for them within a given home range.
We have Nick in Green Bay with a question for you, Scott. Let's go to Nick. Hi, Nick. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just got a quick question for you. Actually, a couple of them. I know for the last couple of years I've been picking up chunks of rabbit. I mean, like, you can't even tell it's a rabbit. But and then the other night I was outside and I heard this thing making a really weird noise. I was like, what the heck is that? So I went trudging through the snow off my waist and looked up and there's a big owl. But I couldn't see much of them. The only reason I knew it was an owl was he was making these clicking sounds, and then he suddenly started making the typical owl sound.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is what's your hypothesis of what kind of owl it is, and how do I keep him in the neighborhood in my woods? Because he's pretty neat. I don't have any problems with him.
Well, very, very soon now, Nick, the most common large owl around the state is a great horned owl. And virtually every suitable woodlot, if the owl's there and they've determined that, hey, this is a pretty good woodlot, and the nesting season for horned owls will be coming up surprisingly quickly here. Yeah. So you'll hear them hooting at night. And just about any woodlot with some big mature trees in it will probably host a pair of horned owls, at least in the general area. And
well, there should be two of them there.
Yes, there'll be two. And before too long, there'll be a nest, and then there'll be more. They'll be multiplying.
Awesome.
So but there are other big owls around. There are lots of barred owls too. Those are the ones that people also hear calling with the distinctive "who cooks for you" kind of call, and you can actually learn how to mimic that and get them talking to you. So, You may have seen one of several species of owls, but the most likely one to be very vocal and very visible and very widely distributed is the great horned owl, and they will be nesting and carrying out that behavior pretty quickly. As far as the chunks of rabbit that you're finding around, that may or may not be the owl. The sad reality, if you're a rabbit, is that just about everybody else out there in the landscape considers you a potential dinner. And whether it's fox or coyotes or hawks or owls or a variety of other potential predators, the fact that there are bits of rabbit fur lying around, and I find them on my property all the time, is just a reflection of the fact that rabbits are really low on the totem pole when it comes to dining preferences.
Okay, yeah, that's great, because it's really exciting to see. I know I got hawks in the backyard, so I'm thinking it's the hawks or the owls. But
thanks for calling, Nick.
You bet.
Appreciate the call. Gary in Boscobel, let's go to you now. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Larry. I wanted to make a comment to Scott and yourself. I've been doing informal turkey surveys in Grant and Crawford, Iowa, Monroe, La Crosse, Vernon counties. In fact, I'm about 60 miles north of Boscobel right now near Wilton, looking for flocks of turkeys. And I'm not finding any. I'm finding, well, I've just covered 60 miles, and I've seen three small groups of turkeys in that 60 miles. And I've been doing this since probably the 1st of December.
Mm-hmm.
And there's times just last week I took a trip over from Boscobel to Linksville on the Mississippi and back through the heart of Crawford County. Never saw a single turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm experiencing that more and more. And I don't know. I just see... It looks like there's kind of the same thing going on in this area that happened to the grouse and the woodcock and the whippoorwills and the Hungarian partridge. And I'm thinking that the comments by the researchers about habitat change are just not quite good enough explanations for these population crashes to really satisfy my curiosity very much.
Well. First comment, Gary, you're not alone in your observation. Lots of folks, I hunt and spend a fair bit of time in Iowa County out your way, and just in talking to other landowners and in passing, say, hey, what happened to the big flocks of turkeys? Because as you well know, if you've been roaming around surveying them, it wasn't too many years ago when you'd hear people calling and say, hey, there's 400 turkeys in the valley this morning. They seem to be all over the place. So there are many such observations. The explanations have not been forthcoming, at least nothing that I've found particularly satisfactory, and I really haven't heard anybody talking too much about habitat change. The habitat change over the course of the demise of grouse populations in the Southwest, I think, is a reasonable explanation, but I don't think there's been enough change over the range or enough time in the presence of abundant turkeys to really be an adequate explanation. What else could be going on? It's kind of hard to say. Sometimes when a population of any animals moves into an area, and I think some of the researchers are seeing the same things with fisher populations in the North Woods, that these animals all of a sudden arrive on the scene and holy mackerel, it's paradise for them. And the turkey population explodes, as it did. But I think there's a tendency with many populations that after that initial flush, there's a bit of a retraction. Mm-hmm. And that may be part of what we're seeing now, too. I think there's also a lot of concern out in your area. And if you're still on, Gary, maybe comment on that, too. I hear other people concerned about what they think are increasing numbers of coyotes and the impact that those animals may be having. So whether it's impact on turkeys or deer or anything else, that's one thing the Department of Natural Resources has high on their priority list, is to try and get a feel with some research over the next couple of years of what the impacts of some of these larger predators are, particularly on deer. But I think it might be safe to assume that there's might be some spin-off impact, if they find any, on turkeys as well.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But you're absolutely right, at least in my own observation and what I hear from other people, same thing.
And Jeff in Boston has a comment relating to turkeys as well, so I want to go to Jeff. Jeff, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, I just want to let the other talker know that about 2 weeks before we lost all the snow in Adams County off Highway Z, and there was probably about 1,000 turkeys in one field.
That's a lot of turkeys.
Yeah, there was so many, you couldn't even count them, so But that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Well, I mean, that's a good bit of information, Larry. I mean, on the one hand, Gary, not so many turkeys. And then another observation comes in from Jeff. Holy cow, hundreds of turkeys, maybe 1,000 turkeys in one area. And it just points up, as we've talked about many times before, that the distribution of any of these animals on the landscape is hardly uniform.
Yeah.
And while they may be here today and then gone tomorrow over here, they're abundant, then they're not. And some of them move around the landscape. Different things change in different parts of the landscape or parts of the state. So it's very difficult for us to sit here and, you know, make generalizations of what's going on statewide. But I have to say that in Gary's defense, and he apparently spends a lot of time out looking around, at least in the areas that I frequent, turkeys seem to be, at least from just simple, straightforward roadside observations, less common than they were a few years ago.
Yeah. And, well, you know, snow or lack of it do you think that could have an impact?
Well, snow affects movements of just about any animal,
and it certainly affects
visibility. I mean, a big, dark turkey stands out like a sore thumb on a snow-covered environment. Now, whether it has, I haven't read the entire article, but I know there's a recent comment that spring turkey tags for the upcoming season will remain at the same level as they were in 2010, and there's been a fairly steady progression of increase in terms of number of turkey tags and in turkey harvest. But the harvest was down last year and in the spring a bit. And
I didn't
get
one.
neither did I, but I didn't hunt either, so it was my own fault. But keeping a lid on the turkey permit expansion and some blips in the harvest may be a reflection of the fact that there is little, not necessarily concern, but observation that maybe things are beginning to level out a bit.
Let's go to John in Marshfield. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
I have a question for both of you. That phenomena of the red-ringed blackbirds falling out of the sky, has that phenomena been ever noted in the state of Wisconsin? I'll take your answer off the air.
Mm-hmm. At least not over the span of my career, which is, we don't need to go into how long that is right now, but I don't recall this kind of thing where a flock of birds seemingly dropped out of the sky in Wisconsin. There have been all sorts of examples of mass mortalities.
Eagles.
Of different wildlife, from eagles to waterfowl to squirrels and assorted other things that have generally been attributed to population fluctuations, disease in some kind, in some cases environmental toxins and a variety of other things. But I don't recall. The short answer is I don't recall anything like these dropping red wings. And I'm very curious to see what happens here.
I think, putting it
in perspective, people need to realize that red wings are an unbelievably abundant species in the millions, tens of millions, and that they're routinely controlled, i.e. killed, in a big way, and in terms of trying to deal with agricultural damage. And particularly in some of those southern states like Arkansas, where rice is a big issue, red wings have been a chronic problem for many years. Now, whether there's anything, we'll just see what they come up with, but it'll be interesting.
It will be interesting. And just for those who don't know, there were several hundred, weren't there, that fell out of the sky?
Maybe as many as 3,000 or 4,000, I heard, that simply during the night, boom, seemed to drop out of the sky dead with no apparent explanation.
And we're checking at it right here in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yes.
Susan in Mequon, it's on to you now. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I have a call about bluebirds.
Okay.
I was really surprised a year ago to see a group of them, I couldn't say a flock, but maybe 6 or 7 out in my wetland. And I thought, oh, my gosh, they're going to die. It was after the first of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And then this year, walking in the wetland, I saw another about 5 or 6 bluebirds quite close. And I'm thinking, what are they doing here?
Well,
over winter?
Typically, no. But again, much like the variation in numbers of animals we see across the landscape that we were just talking about with turkeys, the presence or absence of some of these, what we think of as migratory birds, varies too. And while the vast majority of bluebirds, robins, and other such things clear out, there always seem to be a few that remain. And it's more noticeable with robins, and every winter we get a few calls about, hey, there's a flock of robins here. And the question is, what the heck are they doing? Well, it is generally a few birds that have either, for whatever reason, not made the trip, but have found perhaps suitable habitat, which in the case of robins is usually around a wetland or a spring where there's some open water where they can find food. And if food is present, most of these birds can sustain themselves during the cold temperatures as long as they have some energy for the furnace, so to speak. So there are always a few outliers, and that's the reason why the birders get excited at their winter bird feeders and on the Christmas bird count and whatnot when they find what are apparently strange sightings of birds that you don't expect to be here but are still hanging around.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Susan. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along as we talk about the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or via email at talk@wpr.org. Scott, we had an email from Dave who wonders about the governor's appointment of Scott Gunderson to the position of executive assistant to DNR Secretary Kathy Stepp to oversee wildlife management. What about the intent to appoint a deer management czar? Politics going to trump science here, or what do you think? I put you right on the spot here, or well, at least Dave did.
That's an almost impossible question to answer. I mean, there's really no option here but to be optimistic as we move into a new administration, a new government, a new leadership team, that things will come together. I haven't heard anything recently about the notion of a deer czar. The deer situation is such a horrible mess for anybody to try and sort through. I have no idea how someone would be effective in that particular role, but that's really not on the table now. The new team coming in to oversee the DNR and the board and so forth, we'll just see how things come together. It's just too early to it's too early to say.
Barbara in Avoca, we turn to you. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. I have the type of job where I drive the same 96 miles 6 days a week.
Okay.
And so I'm, observing wildlife all the time and in the same places.
While you're watching the road, of course.
Yes. And I can guarantee you there are plenty of turkeys around. They're out spreading manure right now, and so you see a lot of them out in the fields. But there'll be where I'll see, tons of turkeys, several days in a row, and then you won't see any.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of funny because they're out there.
Yeah.
And you'll see them, and, especially this time of year, they're on the road a lot. And so it is, I know you've commented before that it's the observational thing. It just depends on where you're at and so on and so forth, but there's plenty of turkeys.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling, Barbara. You have an interesting way to, or an opportunity to observe regularly, and I don't think anyone's questioning. In fact, there are plenty of turkeys on the landscape. Turkeys are doing really well, but there seems to be at least some areas where there don't seem to be quite as many of them as there may have been a few years ago, and who knows why. But the message that you convey that we try and point out, just because you don't see something doesn't mean it isn't there.
Yep.
Right, right. And just one more comment. I know a few months ago we were talking about badger observations, and I've seen a badger on my route. It was like just, I couldn't believe, just caught me totally off guard. I just was flabbergasted. And I've seen otter, and it's just, I love my job to just be out, not only what I do, but just be out here and to see the wildlife, the eagles, being here by the Wisconsin River. It's just such a great opportunity. And the other thing is I get to listen to you guys.
Well, that's good, Barbara.
That's a very good thing.
Oh, and speaking of eagles, we've got Eagle Days coming up. We'll be talking about that, I believe, next week on the show with Randy Jerwitz and
Well, we'll just give you a quick primer and give the listeners a chance to get ready. And these eagle viewing days have become very popular over the years. And Sauk City and Prairie du Sac will hold the 24th annual, so it's been 24 years, 24th annual Bald Eagle Watching Days on the 14th and 15th of January. And then over on the Mississippi, Cassville and Prairie du Chien will get in the act and hold their Bald Eagle Days and Appreciation Days in Cassville the end of January 30th and 31st, and in Prairie du Chien, February 26th. And there's a lot of eagles out there. On December 5th, 115 were counted. And that's not surprising because, according to surveys, Wisconsin now has, remember, this was a bird we were afraid we were going to lose.
Right.
1,145 territorial pairs of eagles in Wisconsin.
That's great.
Now. That's pretty cool.
Josh in Wisconsin Rapids emailed in. He said, a few years ago, a man I worked with brought in a picture from a trail camera on his land. The picture was a large cat with no tail and tufts on its ears. I said it was a lynx, but no one agreed with me. Are there lynx in Wisconsin, or was I mistaken?
Do we know where the picture was taken?
Josh, well, he's from Wisconsin Rapids, but the picture could have been from somewhere else. I assume the Wisconsin Rapids area.
Well, you know, amongst our large cats, of course, with a big baseball bat-like tail, then we start thinking cougar, but without a tail, it's either bobcat or lynx. And the tuft on the ears is very distinctive on lynx and less so on bobcat, but it might still be present. You know, I remember once you had the same situation where one of your hunting group had taken a picture, but just on the basis of odds and probabilities, hundreds and hundreds to one, bobcat over lynx. Lynx are a very rare animal in the state. They're, at any given time, there may not even be any here, depending on conditions further north of Wisconsin. But there certainly are records, and there may at any given time also be a handful of them. So we learned a long time ago on the program to never say never. So if it's a, you know, if it's a good quality photograph, that's the kind of thing I'd send on up to the mammals folks in the DNR office, somebody like Adrian Wideven up in Park Falls. Send the picture or send it to us, and we'll send it along and let some folks who know these animals very well have a look. And it's possible that we can vindicate the observation of our caller here and settle the argument for them.
Sounds like a plan. Gavin wonders weasels, excuse me. Is there a certain time in the fall when weasels change colors, or do they change color based on temperature? This year I saw a white weasel a couple of weeks before there was snow. What triggers them to change color?
Well, it's not the presence or absence of snow, or in some winters, you know, weasels would never go white. So it's a matter of photo period, day length, that kind of thing that starts them going. So you can certainly see a white weasel on an otherwise brown landscape, or with late snow cover, you might see the reverse. But our weasels, at least the three small size ones, up to the size of mink. Mink don't change color, but the long tail, the short tail, and the least weasel all turn white.
Rod in Minocqua, we turn to you next. Hi, Rod. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks, guys. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Thanks. I was actually calling about the Red Wings, but you answered the question that I had about control while I was waiting on the phone. And I'm kind of curious about wolf habitat in Wisconsin. I've heard Adrian say for several years that, you know, the wolves have pretty much occupied all the available wolf habitat there is. Yet I live on the edge of the Northern Highland up here, and I don't think there's a pack behind my house, and there's thousands of acres available. And I can't grow a pine tree on my property without deer coming along and chopping the apical meristem. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious, where does that saying that all the wolf habitat that's out there is currently occupied come from?
I suspect it comes from the fact that if you do modeling, mathematical modeling of the landscape in terms of what we as humans, based on the literature, think wolves are looking for in a home, that the vast majority of the habitat is currently occupied. But occupied is a relative term, too. You know, if there's a pack that just may casually move through an area over the course of the many miles a wolf pack may move, even in a night, let alone over the season, then that would qualify as occupied. Whether or not there's room to squeeze more wolves into what we think of as the North Woods and an available habitat, I suspect there is. And the wolves have demonstrated that for quite a while, quite a few years now, as the population continues an upward trend with a few blips here and there. The other complicating factor, Rod, is that wolves, like many animals over the years that I've been involved with this, you know, we thought when turkeys came into the state, well, you know, the turkeys there are going to really be over there along the west central part of the state in that heavily driftless area, lots of rugged country, lots of heavily wooded country. That's where the turkeys are going to be. And look where they are now.
Everywhere.
Everywhere. Even in backyards and city parks, which no one would have predicted. So I think the same is probably true of most of these other things too, including wolves, that they may find that as population pressure builds on the wolves, that what becomes wolf habitat is in the eyes of the wolves, not ours. And we end up seeing animals in places where we didn't really think they would be. So what the upper limits are on these things or where they are or aren't going to be is a little bit fluid and dynamic, and I think Adrian and everybody else would agree on that. But I think the basic contention that prime wolf habitat in Wisconsin, as we identify it as humans or biologists, probably does qualify for the term occupied.
Along the wolf issue, the DNR and the feds are pushing again to delist wolves. What does that mean? Why are they doing it, Scott?
Well, it's been like a ping-pong ball for quite a few years now, Larry, and that causes great aggravation to the folks who feel quite capable in terms of managing wolves. I think the statement that outgoing DNR Secretary Matt Frank made back a few weeks ago, he simply said, we're pleased that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is moving forward to delist the gray wolf. Scientific evidence supports delisting. Transferring management of the wolf to Wisconsin is timely and will lead to improved management through effective action on problem wolves. We've worked closely with the Department of the Interior on wolf delisting over the past 2 years and applaud the proposed action to delist. So I think everything that I know of points toward this being a good thing. However, this was a deal struck, I guess, by a Minnesota senator and encompasses wolves across a couple states in addition to Wisconsin. And even if this goes through, the question is, and I think the senator's comment was in Outdoor News, was whether or not delisting of the species sticks is yet to be seen. And that's where the rub comes in.
Yeah.
They've been delisted before. Then there are legal challenges to the delisting. And a federal judge from who knows where all this, they're not delisted anymore. They're back on the list. And then they're off, and they're on, and they're off, and they're on. And that just greatly complicates the ability of the DNR to effectively manage these local animals.
On a program, and another topic relating to wolves, on a show a while back, it wasn't a show that you were on, Scott, as a guest, but a listener expressed a concern about wolves being a potential hazard to humans. And I noted there was a time when a member of our party was actually followed by some wolves and had to turn around and shoot his gun in the air into the ground, not at the wolves, to scare them. He wanted to scare them off. What are your thoughts on this? And I'd love to hear from Adrian, too, if he happens to be listening.
Well, you know, these animals, the wolves, are large, powerful animals, and they are predators. But there's just no evidence that wolves are a major threat to humans across any of their range. And it was only within a few years ago that there was even a documented case of a human mortality caused by wolves, and I guess there have been one or two since, but it's an incredibly rare event. There are other animals that we don't even give a second thought that pose more of a risk just on the basis of probability and numbers. Having said that, again, prudence is an issue, and whether it was a member of your hunting party or anyone else, when an animal that has a reputation like this, and everybody thinks, oh, the big bad wolf and so forth, they think back to nursery rhymes, and all of a sudden the idea that there may be one or more wolves following you in the woods, We don't know what their motivation is. They may just be curious. Or maybe you're breaking trail, and they're not stupid. Hey, I can put my feet in this trail that this guy's just broken, and it's a lot easier walking. But to make assumptions that they're thinking about me as a possible meal, that's not warranted. Now, again, they have documented the case that they are a threat to dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's your pet or hunting dog or bear trailing hound or whatever else, mm-hmm. there's ample evidence that hunters do need to be prudent. And the DNR has taken steps to issue the email releases where wolves are particularly active, and they post areas where there are packs that have a history of killing dogs to try and prevent those unfortunate incidents. So I think if you have a dog, yes, some prudence and some mm-hmm. concern is completely warranted. In terms of your own safety, no evidence, not so much. But there are certainly some folks around the country and some biologists with long, well-documented credentials that suggest that as this whole thing passes out through history or through the next few years and these animals do become more habituated, that the now small risk may ratchet up a notch or two. But that's been the case with lots of different animals all over the country. If people...
Mountain lions
and coyotes and even some things like elk and whatnot, that if you start hand-feeding these animals or habituating them, that people are no particular threat and are maybe a source of food, sooner or later somebody's going to get bitten or worse. And then all of a sudden the whole dynamic changes. But right now, not a big thing to worry about.
Dan in Partyville, let's go to you now. Hi, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just got on the radio just a little bit ago, just started listening. I know there was one bluebird question, so I don't know if this is a repeat. How odd is it to see bluebirds this time of year? We had a male-female pair at our bird bath on Christmas Day.
Yeah. And that's just what we were talking about.
Exactly what we were talking about. And I guess the short answer, Dan, is it's unusual, but it's not unheard of. And I remember walking in the Arboretum just a number of years ago. I think it was in mid-February. It was bone-chilling cold, and boom, there was a bluebird sitting on a bush. I said, oh, my gosh, pretty cool to see. So it does happen, and the birding literature is replete with examples from the Christmas Bird Count and other sources, but it is unusual. So anything unusual attracts people's attention.
Thanks, Dan. And Rick in South Range, on to you now. Hi, Rick.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you both.
To you as well.
We have a beautiful flock of rough grouse up here. We enjoy watching them. They found the bird feeders quite quickly. But there's a male who sits on one side of this balsam tree,
mm-hmm.
and the other females are over there eating. I'm thinking maybe he's trying to attract them because he's got his feathers all fanned out and his neck is all fluffed up. And it doesn't seem logical that he would be trying to court them. It's certainly not mating season in early January. What is he doing this for?
Well,
maybe he's cold.
He may be cold and fluffing up his feathers, but there may also be amongst what are perceived as a group of females another male or young male that the grouse views as a potential competitor. And even though it's not the prime breeding season, excuse me, even throughout the fall and into winter, you'll occasionally hear a male drumming into the fall, even though it's not breeding season, as we think of it, during the prime drumming season in the spring. So I think at any time of the year, these birds are behaviorally tuned into, boy, another male pretty close here. I ought to keep my eye on that guy because this might be a problem later on. Or from the other side, excuse me. Trying to get the females at least thinking about, you know, I'm here now and in a few months, I could be looking pretty good. So there's really in many cases no way to explain that. But male grouse in particular as well have also exhibited all sorts of weird behavior in terms of becoming incredibly tame. And over the years,
we've had lawnmowers.
Yeah, we've had people call in where particularly a male grouse will come to a feeder and you go out the door to fill the feeder and it'll run over and hop up on your shoulder. We did have them one that rode on a riding lawnmower with another fellow, and just all sorts of weird stories like that. And the literature has many other such stories. So it's one of those things that makes us attracted to grouse. They're pretty. They're a great game bird. They're fun to have around, and they do some weird stuff.
Let's go to Kevin in Tomahawk now. Kevin, hi. Thank you for waiting.
Good morning. Up here in Tomahawk, we occasionally see a few pheasant roosters flying around. And I was just curious why they haven't taken off like the turkeys have and why the DNR doesn't stock them up this way. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right.
Well, first of all, we're really on the northern or northeastern fringe of pheasant range. The North Woods is just not good pheasant habitat. The kinds of wetlands they need to overwinter, the crop fields they need for food, it's just not the prime range for pheasants. So for the same fundamental biological reason that I don't have any grouse around my place in southern Dane County, which is a matrix of cornfields and woodlots, there aren't going to be any pheasants in Oneida County either. That's not to say that there aren't some game farms around where pheasants are released for purposes of hunting, and the opportunity that those birds are going to start a population or survive the winter is very remote, but that's not the prime reason for putting them out there. But the DNR generally stocks only in the southern third to half of the state for the most part for that very reason. Those birds have very little chance of survival and simply not adequate cover even to hold them for short-term hunting opportunity. So the birds that you're seeing around are more likely to be game farm birds or something that an individual has just said, I'm going to buy a crate of pheasants from the Acme Game Farm and we'll put them out here on the farm and have a good pheasant shoot some weekend. And what you're seeing is remnants of an activity like that. Because even down here, in what's left of our prime pheasant range, a wild rooster pheasant has become, over the last couple of years with the winters we've had, has become a very scarce commodity.
We have Mike in Iowa County, who's a wildlife photographer, planning on heading north in the spring in a quest to photograph loons. I want to time my trip so the loons will have chicks with them. Can you give me a time frame of loon nesting habits so I can plan my trip?
Wow. The short answer, Mike, to help you out is no, I can't. I'm guessing that if you go to a book like Robin's Birds of Wisconsin or the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas in particular, which just came out a few years ago, go to the Breeding Bird Atlas, look at the loon section, and for various counties you'll get average dates of nest initiation and so forth. That should guide you very well in terms of sightings of loons. There's a field guide, a temporal and geographic guide to birds in Wisconsin. The authors' names are Temple and Carey. That provides a little chart, basically, for each county as to when these various birds show up and disappear. Those two references, the Breeding Bird Atlas and Temple and Carey's field guide, would be very helpful to you. In the absence of that, I'd make a phone call or send an email to one of the DNR folks who works with loons, somebody like Mike Meyer up at the Rhinelander DNR office, and I would guess that in a reply email you could get a pretty good insight from somebody who spends a lot of time out on the lakes with these birds as to when you might want to be there. Another researcher at Michigan Tech by the name of Dan Haskell, who could also provide the same information. But if you want to send in a request, if some of these things you didn't get them written down, send an email to Larry or I, and we'll get you that information.
And thanks again for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest today as we talk the world of wildlife with him. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. And Todd wonders if you can settle a bet, Scott. He says, I say that coyotes are predators for deer only for the fawns in spring and for injured animals anytime. My friend says that coyotes will also kill many healthy adult deer. Who is right?
Well, I think we need to discuss here first what our respective cut is going to be in settling this bet, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to go with your friend based on a lot of information, but also on some concerns of folks in Wisconsin operating their trail cameras and what they're seeing and not seeing that. At least in some cases, and particularly under certain conditions of snow and deer health and so forth, that even adult deer and relatively healthy-appearing adult deer may be at some risk. But certainly most of these animals, I mean, they're not going to, they will take the path of least resistance. So a fawn or a deer that's debilitated by CWD or some other problem is certainly at greater risk, but I think there's probably some risk to just about any deer.
Randy in Milton, on to you now. Hi, Randy.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
Well, I wanted to, I heard you talking about pheasants earlier, and I just wanted to ask about prairie chickens. It's my understanding pheasants are not a native bird to Wisconsin.
Correct.
But prairie chickens are, and we don't see any around, you know, especially in my area, and I'm just curious where in the state they are and why we don't see them and what was the existing range of these birds, and if you could just expand on that a little.
Well, prairie chicken, you're right, first of all. Pheasants are a non-native species. They actually came from Asia. However, they were introduced into the United States well over a century ago, and they've been around in some areas, including Wisconsin, for so long that relative to concern over what we now think of as invasive species, pheasants have sort of been granted a little bit of a free pass here as kind of a naturalized citizen in some people's minds. But yeah, you're correct. They are a non-native species. However, prairie chickens are a native species, and they were widely distributed over southern Wisconsin in historical times when most of what we had was prairie and oak savanna, and suitable habitat for prairie chickens was rapidly converted into agriculture, and they retreated to a few strongholds, particularly in the central part of the state, up around Plainfield and whatnot, the Buena Vista Marsh and areas over towards Crex Meadows, a big open wildlife area in the west central part of the state. And really what we're dealing with prairie chickens now is a few small isolated remnant populations. And there's a lot of people working on attempting to preserve those remnant populations. There's concern over genetic exchange amongst these isolated populations, and birds are being brought in from other areas, or there's talk of other types of activities to attempt to bolster the genetic diversity of the remaining prairie chickens and make sure that in perpetuity there's at least some prairie chickens remaining in Wisconsin where there's suitable habitat. But there's not a lot of suitable habitat left.
That's the problem. All right, thanks, Randy. Lisa in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Have any wolverines ever been radio collared in Wisconsin?
No. Wolverines were gone from Wisconsin before radio telemetry was a tool or a technique or even available.
Any documented cases of them, like Michigan?
There have been a couple of sightings of wolverines in Wisconsin and even a road-killed individual down in Monroe County a number of years ago. But I think any cases where wolverines have turned up, and as I say, there have been a couple cases, when those were investigated, those animals were traced back to game farms or essentially private operations, not a wild population. We're a long way from viable wolverine populations for those animals to get here on their own.
Does Michigan have a documented case?
I'm trying to think. There were some issues with wolverines and so forth, but I have a feeling that those two were traced back to
game farms.
I mean, there are a lot of wolverines in the Ann Arbor area, but that's a different kind, and we don't think much about them.
Okay.
But I can't tell you for sure what the Michigan situation is, but I think it's similar to ours. We're just a long way from viable wolverine populations.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. And John in Oshkosh, we turn to you now. Hi, John.
Hi, yeah. I'm calling just about a question I have about the Apostle Islands. They recently lifted the gun ban up there, and there was some debate amongst people up there whether the deer management was under the jurisdiction of the National Park Service or the DNR. And my question stems just from the fact that there is a sharpshooter who gets paid apparently $70,000 a year to bait and shoot deer in what is deemed to be an overpopulated island, Sand Island.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were saying, you know, what's the point in hiring a guy $70,000 a year to do something that individuals would do if you allowed them to do it?
$70,000 sounds a little high.
Sounds like a good retirement opportunity.
Yeah.
A good gig if you can get it. Well, I understand your concern, John. That's a fairly common thing when agencies, any agency, feels they need to control a wildlife population, and they do it either with staff or with hired people, And there are many, presumably many willing hunters who would do this if the circumstances allowed it, whether it's safety or landowner concerns or whatever they may be. I'm just not familiar enough with what's going on up in the Apostles right now to tell you. I think the National Park Service trumps state management as far as wildlife on the islands, and their policy, I think, is largely hands-off if population changes, increase or decrease, are deemed to be natural. If there's something going on where, say, an exploding deer population is attributed to some type of human activity or human intervention or human establishment of the animals, then the Park Service intervenes, and whether it's actually by a well-paid sharpshooter or not, I can't tell you. But I certainly think there are some folks up there, either in the Park Service office in Bayfield or in the DNR offices nearby, who could tell you exactly what's going on there. I just can't.
And I just went online, and I was looking at it, and it says, I put in NPS.gov, National Park Service, and it says it may come as a surprise to some visitors to learn that hunting is permitted in the Apostle Islands. And I can look into that a little bit more and find out some more. Hunting activity may occur from September after Labor Day through the first week of January. So I can look into that a little bit more and see what I can come up with. But I just put in the search engine deer management on the Apostle Islands, and that popped up first. So, John, you might want to take a look at that too. Mark in Green Bay, we turn to you next. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi. Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
Sure.
I'd like to discuss who I think are the biggest slobs in the sporting community, and that'd be waterfowl hunters. I know I'm going to probably not make a lot of friends in this, but I have the bad luck of living and the good luck of living along the shores of Green Bay, so I get to watch what goes on out here. And I don't understand why they allow three shots per shotgun. All it does is lend to way too high a rate of crippling, and there's very little attempt to retrieve the birds where you've got Phragmites grass that once a duck gets in there, he's gone. Why isn't it a one shot? Make people aim instead of just blasting.
Well, in fact, the very reason that it's limited to three shots is to prevent or at least in some ways mitigate what you're describing. Many shotguns are capable of handling,
unless it's
an over and under or double barrel where you're limited to two. A lot of pump action or semi-automatic guns, which are popular with waterfowl hunters, could hold five or with an extended tube, eight or even more shells. However, by federal law and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, waterfowl hunters are limited to three rounds. So the gun has to be plugged, physically plugged, so that its capacity in both the chamber and the magazine cannot exceed three. And that's to prevent exactly what you're talking about, which is wild. Sure, there goes a flock of ducks. Boom, 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 and simply expend whatever capacity of ammunition you have. I'm sure there are probably cases where even the three shots may, even with a single shotgun, there might even be a reverse tendency. Gee, I've only got one shot. Gee, that duck's a long ways away, but what the heck, I'll take a poke at it. Mm-hmm. I think to go below three might even be counterproductive in some ways. So I think that, as you've indicated, you see some behavior you don't like. There's probably behavior people don't like in any activity that humans participate in. And at least in the case of number of shots and waterfowl hunters, that three-shot limit has been in place for a very long time. And I think it's accepted by waterfowl hunters, and they know what the rationale is. But that doesn't change someone's individual behavior who either hasn't taken the time to learn what a duck at 40 yards looks like as opposed to a duck at 80 yards. And whether they take the shot or not is up to their own individual ethics. And it's very difficult to deal with anything like that.
Yeah, it sure is. Mark, thank you for calling. Jeannie in Dodgeville, on to you. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My family lives in a very heavily wooded area in southwestern Wisconsin, and we have a very large coyote population.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any humane way to reduce them?
Well, that's a little difficult to address because in some senses, what's humane and what isn't is in, well,
the eyes
in the eyes
beholder.
Of the beholder, to use Larry's term. I find, for example, personally, a firearm in the hands of someone who knows how to use it and can deliver a shot that kills an animal, any animal, quickly, is humane in my mind. There are other people mm-hmm. who would vehemently disagree with that. So in terms of reducing your coyote population, there are things that would be entirely unacceptable, like use of poisons, simply because they're not legal or registered to use, and they could inflict a death that might be very prolonged and agonizing for the animal. That would be unacceptable for virtually everybody and legally unacceptable. On the other side of the fence, there are certainly trappers in the area that you could make contact with through the Wisconsin Trappers Association who could remove some animals. The animal would be caught, and then presumably once they're caught in, say, a foothold trap, they are dispatched in, again, what some people would consider a humane fashion and others not. Or there are hunters who will hunt them with hounds and dogs and so forth. So you have to see where you come down on that and how much you want to get rid of those coyotes.
Thank you for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, will be with us up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network. Talking the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. And join in with your own questions or comments, either by phone or via email. Phone number 1-800-642-1234. Email talk@wpr.org. Scott, the Wisconsin DNR has a new, they've debuted a new website that really is user-friendly.
It's quite nice. Actually, I've checked it out a couple of times, and you can go to wisconsinwi.gov.
dnr.wi.gov.
And both of the websites are, you can click on either one, and they're asking people to take a look at the new layout and offer some feedback. It's not finalized yet, and they haven't completely transitioned to the new website, but I assume that's coming up here sometime this winter or spring. But they welcome public feedback, and you know, you can kind of go to it now, and if you're interested in fishing, hunting, state yeah. parks, swimming, whatever, it's very easy to kind of get into that sphere of information. It's pretty nice.
So take a look at it, and they're looking for comments. And again, it's dnr.wi.gov. They're looking for comments, and it's much more user-friendly than the old one.
Mm-hmm.
Brian in Green Bay, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Quick comment on you. I was very intrigued with your discussion last month on the shrews, the short-tailed shrews.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I got home and come to find one in my dog's food bucket.
Ah,
cool.
And, you know, tried to release it a couple times. It hightailed right back into the garage. It must have liked it. So I just figured I'd let it be. It must have had something to do in there. And then a couple of days later, go back to the food bucket. This time it's got a dead mouse in there.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So it's killed the mouse. So I just kind of figured, oh, he's doing a good job keeping the mice out of my garage.
Yep.
Now, then the next concern comes is when I take my car to get the oil changed. And the mechanic comes back with a bag full of dog food. And the shrew has been taking food out of the dog bucket, putting it up into my car, and packed the air filter full.
Ah!
Don't blame the shrew for that. The mouse that it killed is the culprit. White-footed mice or deer mice that are the ones that are in the garages right now are notorious for lugging dog kibble and nuts and seeds and whatever else and packing them into boots and shoes and air filters and any other confined space they can find. So the mice are the culprit, and you were right in the first time in crediting the shrew with working on your behalf. So if it kills any mice, then it's doing a good service in preventing that caching, but the caching activity you're seeing is the mice.
Well, I just want to thank you for sharing that. I was very intrigued with the shrews, and to come home that very day and find one, it was kind of funny, and being able to identify it was very nice.
Oh, that's great. Good. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, guys.
Appreciate it. Mike and Viola, let's turn to you now. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I was just calling to, I missed the early part of your show, and I was outside doing stuff and came in for a cup of coffee, and lo and behold, I heard the comment on, your guest was talking about how wolves really aren't a threat to people as far as them stalking or anything like that, but, and I guess I'm living proof to that in a sense, because, earlier this, last year, I guess now, I keep forgetting we're in 11, I was bear hunting up around Antigo, and earlier in the week when I, my buddy and I had come back from town, we saw a big wolf cross the road right by his second driveway. This was around noon. And 2 days later, when I was coming out of my stand bear hunting, I was heading back, and I got a fair amount of distance away from the stand, and because I'd been sitting there all day, I had to take care of nature. So I stopped along... it's called a railroad grade. It's like a clear cut. It looks like a logging road to most people, but they call it a railroad grade. And I looked off to both sides, and there was nothing there. I was expecting to possibly see a deer or something like that, or maybe a bear. And I noticed this animal coming up, and at first I thought, well, is that a coyote? What is that? You know, and it's getting dark. It's right after quitting time, but it's getting dark, but it's I could still see. And as I'm... finishing my business, and this animal's coming closer and closer and closer, and I'm like, what's going on here? So anyway, I moved, and it wasn't like it couldn't tell my shape or thought I was a deer or something like that. I was standing up, and when I moved, this thing went into a crouch, and it kept coming closer and closer, crouching, and I'm like, okay, what's going on here? So I had one of those LED pen lights in my vest. So I took that out and, you know, shined it right in its eyes, and it continued to come closer. And it kept crouching down, you know, and it got closer and closer. Well, finally, I had both hands on the flashlight, and I'm following it around, just shining it right in its eyes. And it's a bright little light. And this thing finally stopped crouching and stalking, and stood up, and then went behind a bush in a tree, and I thought, wow, that was cool. You know, and meanwhile, I've got my rifle on a sling over my shoulder, and I thought, oh, okay, I didn't have to use that. And it came around the brush again, and then continued to come closer. And I thought, oh, yay, what have we... And as it turned out, I just kept the flashlight in it, and I kind of, like, coughed. And it stopped, but it kept lingering. And as... as it would happen, it went into the brush the same direction that I had to take this path. It was real wet around Antigo and that last fall, and I had to go through a lot of water to get back to camp. I'm in the woods of probably a half a mile, three-quarters of a mile, and it was a neat experience. I mean, that's a lot of the hunting experience that a lot of non-hunters or antis wouldn't get, but... and it's probably one of the coolest experiences I've had ever hunting. But this thing stalked me. It and it couldn't have mistaken me for anything. You know. And but it was very intent, you know, and
How close did it get to you? How close did it get to you?
We went back the next day because we were baiting the site. The furthest it could have been when it went around the brush, because I had to recalculate where I was standing when I got out to that clearing, 20 yards tops.
Yeah, that's, I mean, individual animals have different distances that they consider, you know, too close for comfort. But the way you describe the situation in a wet year, a railroad grade, a linear path through the cover, I mean, what you were walking on was probably what most of the wildlife in that area chooses to walk on as well. It's easy going. It was dry going. And the animal may have just been coming in that direction. So, oh, man, there's something in the way here. Now, how am I don't want to really go off into the swamp here. And who knows? The bottom line is you ended up with a neat experience and you view it that way. No harm, no foul kind of thing. What its intentions were, whether it was simply curious, whether it was a young animal that, although, you know, just didn't know what the heck you were and was interested in checking it out, or it really wanted to just get beyond you and on to where it was going and you were kind of blocking the path, who knows? But as you say, those are the kinds of things that for a lot of people, you seem to have taken it fairly well. I can imagine some other people who would have just come completely unglued in such a circumstance, and then who knows what happens. So.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks for calling. Thank you very much for calling. Tom in Waterloo, It is your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry and Scott. Say, for years, as a farmer here in Waterloo, when I'm plowing, every fall I get hundreds and hundreds of seagulls that show up out of nowhere. We're in the middle of nowhere. There's no landfills nearby. There's no large bodies of water. Where do these darn seagulls come from?
Well, it, depending on the species, some of them are resident birds that are spending most of their time around landfills or coastlines or large lakes or whatever. But also in the fall, there are large numbers of gulls of other species that are moving through. And watching seagulls congregate in a freshly turned field is a pretty common sight.
Yeah.
And the flocks will simply lift up and just continue to relocate right behind the tractor, because you're turning over a lot of things that they're interested in, like night crawlers and other invertebrates and things that, hey, this is pretty easy pickings for the gulls. So why they're there is easily explainable. How the word gets out that, hey, Tom's plowing over near Waterloo, let's go, guys. That's another bit of a mystery. But as you say, in part, it may be just birds passing through that are picking out habitat and feeding opportunities that they've learned before are pretty good.
They're pretty good. Yep, there you go. Thank you, Tom. Mary in Iowa County, we are on to you. Hi, Mary.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, I'm calling for a friend who had a very brief sighting and was starting to get dark, but I wondered if there was any other sightings of what might be a fisher this far south.
In Iowa County.
Yeah.
Sure. I have a very nice picture on the wall of my office taken by a DNR colleague of a fisher perched in a poplar tree out in Governor Dodge State Park a few years ago. And then we had another fellow who had a good picture of one in Columbia County just a year or so ago. So, yes, they are around, whether resident or passing through, accidental or what have you. There have been some valid sightings, so I would certainly not rule out the possibility that that's what your friend may have seen in Iowa County.
Oh, yep. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that. Well, thank you very much.
Yep, mm-hmm. Thanks for calling. Phil from Belleville emails, any estimate of the number of moles per unit area in, for example, an occasionally mowed field? Are they active under snow if the ground's not frozen? Over what distance do they move?
Well, very good question. The common mole or prairie mole is something of an enigma to most people. You almost never see the live animal. I mean, but they're really cool animals. They're built well for what they do, and they're strange-looking things. Look like they're out of a Steven Spielberg movie. But anyway, the amount of activity that an individual mole can create, the mounds of soil or the raised ridges or those kinds of things, is what we use to index mole activity. People don't see the mole. They see the tunnels and the pushed-up dirt. Well, the issue is that these things are incredibly active. So I've seen statistics that an individual mole can dig maybe on average 150 feet of these raised ridges that you see in a night's activity. Okay, so generally speaking, if this is a problem in your backyard or on a trail system around your property or in a mowed field, you see all these tunnels and mounds, think, oh my gosh, there must be gazillions of them, when in fact it's usually only a handful. They generally don't occur in very high densities. It's just that on an individual basis, they can do so much of what we see that the impression is that they're incredibly abundant. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is the damage is very annoying. The good news is that if you learn how to use some of the tactics that people use to control moles, whether it's traps or the new gummy worms that are infused with a toxicant that will kill moles, or some of the bacon trap technique that we talked about on the show last summer, no matter what you use, you don't have to control or kill more than a few moles before the problem's under control. They are active all year. They don't hibernate. They simply go down in the soil column to avoid the freeze line. So if you get an early deep snow that insulates the ground and there is no frost line, then in answer to the question, yes, the moles will be active very close to the surface. But typically once the ground starts to freeze, they go deeper and they're out of sight, out of mind until things start to melt in the spring and the soil dries out enough for them to come back up and be visible again.
We have some emails here. Let's see. There is an email from, Stacy says, there he was, Mr. Robin Redbreast, looking very confused, perched on our shepherd's hook with the other feeders. Monday afternoon, everything is covered with snow, and he looked very out of place.
Well, they do, and that's more. The bird may not have felt that way. Bird may have known exactly what it was doing and felt pretty good about the situation. But our perspective on these generally summer birds is, wow, something must be horribly wrong here. But as we said, occasionally some of these birds do stay around.
And then from Lorna, regarding the question of when to observe loon chicks, the Loon Watch website has an abundance of information as well. Loonwatch at northland.edu. So it's loonwatch at northland.edu. In our Speakers Bureau program, we're told 4th of July weekend is the most dangerous for loon chicks because that's when they're very small and vulnerable. So in most areas, chicks are born frequently during the weeks of June, although they may appear sooner or even later.
So well, I think that was for Mike back in Iowa County. Anyway, Mike, there's a good source of information for you.
Loonwatch at northland.edu. And here's somebody who does not want their name used, who worked with the Park Service on Sand Island for several years. We're talking back to the Apostle Islands. Mm-hmm. And the sharpshooter story is true. Shooters from U.S. Fish and Wildlife are paid more than $70,000 each, not per year, but for several weeks of hunting, even though they hunt at night using an infrared scope. Their numbers have not been as successful as the public hunt and private hunts using park employees and volunteers. Sand Island does have a very severe deer problem. Hopefully the wolves that crossed the ice a couple of years ago will take care of some of them. The meat from the sharpshooter and other deer management programs is donated to the Red Cliff Tribal Elders Food Program.
Hmm.
So that's from somebody who used to work
well,
there.
Well, that answers a lot of the questions, except why... I guess the fundamental question on that particular island, why is you know, public hunting opportunity not doing the job?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, it does a better job than the sharpshooters, according to our emailer here.
Hmm. Okay. Inside information.
Steve in Cascade, hello to you.
Hey, good morning. I got a question. with today's technology, Mr. Craven, you think the DNR is going to eventually, like, I hunt the Dakotas, I can register my deer either over the phone or through texting. And most states, you know, you just call an 800 number,
mm-hmm.
you give them your customer service number, you know, you tag your animal, you call it in, it's boom, 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 you go back home, bang, it's locked on your thing and you're all set to go.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that it's antiquated in this state driving around, you know, looking for a place to register and going through all that. I was just wondering if they were ever going to go to that.
Well, that's a pretty good question, Steve, although I think there are other reasons, you know, beyond convenience. The information collected at the registration stations is considered a valuable part of Wisconsin's deer management program. And the sexing and aging of the harvest that the people manning the check stations do, the collection in some areas of samples for chronic wasting disease testing or for survey or surveillance work, and the information gleaned from the hunters, you know, specifically where were you on the map and so on and so forth. Stickers change hands, for example, in the CWD area. If you register an antlerless deer, you can get your buck sticker on the spot. There, the Wisconsin situation is such that there are still some pretty valid reasons why they do the registration the way they do. And I've not heard any... not heard any rumbling about changing that.
Yeah.
I understand your issues, but some of the other states don't have the kinds of detailed data-driven management plans that Wisconsin does.
There you go. Thanks, Steve. Don in Germantown. On to you now. Hi, Don.
Hi. Good afternoon, guys.
Good afternoon.
Spectacular as usual. I wanted to ask a quick question regarding you. I talked about owls earlier in the show. And what... what would be the odds of attracting an owl to a house, a built house, kind of like wood ducks?
Well, some of the owls wouldn't be at all interested in that, but there are some species that are. For example, although they're very rare, barn owls are routinely managed by putting up houses. Screech owls respond to nest boxes as well, but those are little tiny guys compared to the two owl species we were talking about earlier. So some owls do respond to nest boxes, but others, like the great horned, that are more likely to take over an old crow nest or hawk nest or whatever in a big tree, would not be the least bit interested in a nest box, no matter where it were placed or with what intentions.
There you go.
Thanks.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Scott, we've got a new wildlife phenology calendar out that is really beautiful.
It is pretty, Larry, and this has been a cooperative effort. This calendar has been a cooperative effort of the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the Leopold Foundation, UW Extension, for a number of years now. So this is the 2011 version, beautiful butterfly and purple coneflower photo on the cover. And I think the neat thing, you can get lots of calendars that have beautiful pictures, which this one does too. But I think the real advantage here is that as you go through, virtually every date has some sort of a notation of something that you might observe in the wild, or if you see the notation, you might go out and look for it. What's blooming by way of flowers, when the birds are coming back. Hey, there may be an entry on here somewhere about loon chicks being born, you know, the kinds of things that people are curious about on the program. There are, on any given month, for as I thumb through here, you know, there's hardly any days that don't have a phenological entry. So a lot of interesting information to keep you tuned into the natural world and a pretty calendar to begin with. And you can order that. The ordering information is inside on that email. It can be purchased through the Learning Store, I think, through our own extension organization, yes, as well as through the partner organizations.
So, if you just go to the Learning Store, UW Extension Learning Store, you can order a copy of it. And it really is a beautiful calendar. And I wish I had one. You've got one, and I don't have one.
Well, Larry, you might find that will come
fork
into your
over
possession.
Over a couple of bucks. Well, you know, here we are with a minute or two to go, Scott. As we look back at 2010, Natural Resources highlights. What would, in your mind, would be some of those highlights?
Well, you know, every year the DNR comes out with a summary of their weekly news that goes back through highlights of the year. And as I looked through this, there were a few things that came to mind. The new hunting mentorship program has proven to be a big hit. That was a big innovation. The deer harvest ticked back up a little bit. That was good news. The bear situation, and we documented a larger bear population than we thought we had, so permits and bear harvest has been ratcheting up. It was a very safe deer season until a recent unfortunate accident here at the end of the year. There are lots of research projects going out. I think the fact that the serious drought in a lot of northern Wisconsin to a certain degree broke a bit this year and filled up some of those lakes and flowages, that was great. New rules in place to protect bats, new rules in place to control feral pigs and mute swans and some other problem species. The fact that VHS testing determined that was not spreading inland in Wisconsin, that was excellent news. CWD management plan was approved by the board back in October, so that's in place for the next 15 years. Cougars were documented by DNA analysis, so we finally got that monkey off our back, and you know, just lots of other good things going on. So despite the long-term frightful things like global climate change and other such issues, there's still a lot of good things happening, and for the most part, our resources here in Wisconsin are in pretty darn good shape, and hopefully will continue to be so.
Scott, thank you so much. Scott Craven, Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. He'll be back on the first Wednesday of February. Tomorrow, I'll be in Wausau giving a talk from 9 to 10, and then at 11 o'clock, we'll be broadcasting from our Wausau studios, talking with Jane Wynicke of the Woodson Art Museum, and also Wausau kayaker Jake Strakovac. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.